Hello, storytellers and creatives, and welcome to season one, episode six of the Write Script Reviews. And today we're going to be talking about Grey's Anatomy, season 17, episode one. And you all might be wondering why I'm not starting from the very beginning of the series. For those of you who don't know, Grey's Anatomy is long, okay? Grey's Anatomy, for all you diehard Grey's Anatomy fans, you all know that this series goes all the way back to the year 2005, and we're in the year 2021. I wasn't about to go that far. I figure I'm already caught up with the show. I'm on season 17 already. So I'm just gonna start here. If it wasn't such a long show, like if it only had like six, five, or four seasons, I'd be like, okay, I can start from the beginning, but 17 seasons, that's a lot. Okay, so we open up, and the name of this episode is All Tomorrow's Parties. Interesting title, considering, what they're dealing with now. 2020 is upon them. The pandemic is in full effect, straight up chaos in the hospital. And there's a quick recap. In the previous season, DeLuca was accusing a woman of being a child trafficker of this teenage girl, and it turned out he was right, but everyone thought he was crazy because it came out that he has mental issues. I forgot what they are specifically, but it could be schizophrenia, it could be manic depression, bipolar, any of those three. Then we see that Amelia and Link had their son. They named him Scout. And of course, it wouldn't be Grey's Anatomy without the Teddy and Owen saga. So, quick recap. She cheated with Dr. Karasik. Owen was being wishy-washy about setting a date for the wedding. And in all fairness, if you guys know the history of Teddy and Owen has pretty much always given Teddy the runaround. Teddy was always like the consolation prize, second choice. She was never the one that he was like, oh yeah, I want you without a shadow of a doubt. It was always either the woman before Teddy didn't really want him, like with Christina, even though she's not on there anymore, the reason that Owen and Christina ended up getting a divorce and moving on is because Owen always wanted to be a family man. He wanted kids, the whole nine yards, the white picket fence, the dog, all that stuff. Christina just wanted to be a career woman. Yeah, she was cool with the whole marriage thing as long as it was more modern, not traditional. She totally was not that chick, right? And then he ended up getting with Teddy. And before that, he was even with Amelia, but he ended up even choosing Amelia over Teddy. And so Teddy has, for some odd reason, put up with a lot from Owen. And that's how Karasik was able to really get her to the point where she wanted to sleep with him. Because Karasik even said during the final season or the season before this one, that he still hasn't like set a date for the wedding. What's that about? Is he ever gonna marry you? I mean, he did have his baby and he's still dragging his feet. And even though it's arguably none of Karasik's business, of course he played on her pain point, her insecurity, even though it was true. That's when she was like, yeah, you're right, but here's the kicker of what happened at the end of season 16. Teddy ended up butt dialing Owen and she left her phone on, and Owen was about to go into surgery with glasses and with all the other people, and they all ended up hearing Teddy and Karasik having sex through the phone. And so at this point, Owen knows that Teddy cheated, but Teddy doesn't know that he knows. So that's a whole mess, right? And then Meredith's voiceover comes in. And for all of you Grey's Anatomy people, you know that Meredith always has the best voiceovers. And with voiceover, this is a great example of using, metaphors, a little bit of imagery, not too much, but enough to the point where it's relatable. Meredith says, "I've heard that when tidal waves hit, there are often people watching on shore. They see the disaster coming. They see the horizon disappearing. They don't really see until it's too late. There's a lecture we take in residency that's meant to prepare us for such surprises. It's called Disaster Ethics, where future surgeons imagine what they would do when the unimaginable happens, then jolted back to reality. Meredith is now in the hospital, April 2020. Chaos is in full effect. COVID-19 is running rampant all over the place." And her voiceover continues. She goes on to say, "But it's imperfect because while it's good to plan for the worst, you can't really know how you'll handle it until you're smack dab in the middle of it, under the wave, trying not to drown." This dialogue was extremely powerful because what is the big wave that they're dealing with? COVID-19. They're human. This virus is killing more patients than they can keep up with. They haven't had any time to take a break or to breathe. They're having to deliver bad news to all the families. And the question is, they're taking care of all these people, but who's taking care of them? They're human too. And then we see Miranda Bailey. Of course, she's lecturing everyone about continuing to use safety precautions during the pandemic. We see a brief moment where she's waving goodbye to her husband while he goes back to the fire station. Remember, Benjamin Warren started out as a surgical resident, but then he decided, yeah, surgery's not for me. I think I'm going to go fight fires instead. Remember that? Miranda was so upset when he did that, but now she's at peace with it. But we see them now, and they have to social distance, they have to stay 6 feet apart. And it's really sad because you can see within their eyes that they want to hug each other, they want to be there for each other, but they never really see one another anymore. Different schedules, demanding jobs, they're like two ships passing in the night. And remember, Miranda suffers from anxiety. And that's another thing I tell you guys too, when it comes to character development, core wounds, and character arc and flaws. Miranda Bailey is a total perfectionist. Everything has to be just so. She suffers from OCD. Everything has to be straightened up. Everything has to be the way that she pictured it, or else she freaks out, right? Characters like that are relatable because they're humanized and they're also able to be seen in a different light. They're not so above reproach or so quote unquote perfect, and they don't do everything by the book to the point where they're not relatable. People can look at Miranda Bailey and see themselves like, hey, she suffers from this just like me. I really identify with that character. That is how you hook people in when you give them something wrong with them or that they have to deal with that the average person is combating in life. And then the good news, Richard Weber is back after his recovery, and he has no idea how much has changed within the hospital when it comes to protocol. And Miranda wastes no time telling him. She's like, oh, everything has changed. Specialties are no longer a thing. Surgeons check temperatures. Attendings do scut. It's a madhouse. And the terminology, attendings, normally don't do scut. That's normally for a first-year resident, somebody that has to work hard and prove themselves, and to have an attending doing that, you know things have changed. Then we see Maggie, and she's on the phone with Winston, and they're in a long distance relationship. He's a doctor too, but he works at a different hospital. But it seems like a healthy union thus far. And the thing about Maggie is that she overthinks a lot, and she has a history of self-sabotaging herself. Hopefully, this isn't another one of those moments, but then the phrase, "I love you," comes up from Winston, and Maggie cannot hide her shock, her tense body language. She can't hide it at all. She's like, okay, bye, And then that poses the question, will that make Maggie run away from Winston? Will she do the predictable thing and say, oh my God, this is going too fast. I'm scared. Let me stop it right now before it gets any further. Typical Maggie, right? And then we see a man getting his temperature taken, and he says, I don't want a Chinese doctor. Again, media programming, hard at work. And I love how they added that because it's showing how a lot of people have bought into the propaganda about how, oh, this is the Chinese disease. Oh, if you're around a certain ethnicity or group of people, you're going to get the virus. When people with common sense know that's not true, but people who are quick to believe anything or any narrative out there, they'll run with it. And that was an example. And then we see Meredith, and she is just at a breaking point. She goes up to Meredith, not Meredith, Miranda and Richard, and she's like, Marvin Lindstrom, 83. He was fine yesterday, became hypoxic an hour ago. It is the fourth patient I've lost today, and they're all dying alone. Welcome back, Richard. Yeah, that's such a warm welcome, right? But it's a blunt welcome, and it's true. I mean, Richard is being slapped with the hard truth that this is not the hospital you once knew. This is not Gray Sloan Memorial that you're used to. This is a new day, a new protocol, the quote unquote new normal that's being pushed. That's what's happening. And then a teenager with burns on his face from a car explosion is admitted into the hospital. And once again, we're back on Richard, and we can tell he feels some type of way about all the changes, and he's hatching a plan in his head. You can see the wheels turning. And then the girl that DeLuca revealed is a victim of being human trafficked comes back, and her name is Cindy Wright. And she returns to thank DeLuca for speaking the truth about her being a victim. And she was like, I'm so sorry, you guys. I was scared. I didn't listen. I got sicker, and Opal said I was useless. She dropped me off on the side of the interstate, but I remembered the name of the hospital and you. And then we see Jackson and Joe Wilson. And here's a little recap on what happened with Joe Wilson. All the diehard Grey's Anatomy fans know that she and Alex Karev were like goals, right? They both came from broken homes. They were both impoverished. They both dealt with a lot of adversity at young ages, and they both became surgeons through all that pain, all that trauma, all that heartbreak, through all of it, right? And what happened is Alex Karev ended up leaving Joe high and dry. Now, Joe wasn't just a girlfriend, she was his wife. They were in the middle of maybe deciding to have children, and it came out that Alex went back to Izzy because she had his children and he had no idea. And so he just up and left, sent her a note. Didn't sit down with her, break it to her gently? No, he just straight up ripped the band-aid. So now Joe is a mental and emotional mess. She's traumatized. She's dealing with a lot. And she goes to Jackson Avery and she's like, "Hey, I really need to hook up with you. I really need sex. You're like a bridge. I'm trying to date. I'm trying to get out there, but you're the only man I trust right now after what happened with Alex. So I just need you right now." And at that point, Jackson is like, "Are you sure about that?" 'Cause the thing about Jackson, he's not really a one-night stand type of guy. I'll show you in a minute, but this is also a good writing tip when it comes to how Joe is dealing with being abandoned by Alex. It shows how people react during trauma. Ideally, we would expect people to be like, "Oh yeah, let me go talk to somebody." Normally, when it first happens, people don't want to deal with it directly because it's too painful. They don't want to deal with that trauma. They don't want to deal with reality and facing the truth. Like, my husband left me high and dry without so much as telling me to my face. He wrote a note. And that's way too painful to unpack at that moment. So, what better way to put a temporary band-aid on her trauma and her pain by having her resort to friends with benefits, casual sex, alcohol, some type of vice, right? That's typically how a lot of people deal with hurt, pain, and trauma, unfortunately. And then we see Meredith calling more families, telling them that their loved one has died due to COVID. And we see the toll it's taking on her, and nobody ever wants to make that call. Then we see that the shipment of so-called masks are finally here, and Karasik is like, Yep, I ordered the masks. I'm your hero, blah, blah, blah. And everyone's so excited, like, yay, finally, new masks. We need new ones. The old ones are falling apart. But they open up the boxes only to find out that none of these have masks in them. They're booties. The little, I don't know how you call them. They're like what doctors and medical people wear when they're in the hospital on their feet, I guess, to prevent the spread of germs. So all those are in the boxes, but not the masks. And Karasik is so upset that he takes a golf club and starts just whacking the boxes, and he just goes into a rampage. And that's real. This pandemic is literally bringing out the worst in people. And I remember, like, I'll have an honest moment right here. When I was watching this and other TV shows that were showing the pandemic, I was like, ugh, I wanted to get an escape from it. But, how realistic would that be? This is a medical drama. Of course, they're going to show the pandemic and what's going on. That would really be insulting our intelligence if they didn't, and they acted like COVID wasn't really a thing. You know what I mean? And then we see the parents of the boy who has severe burns freaking out, and they're like, "We want to see our son. We need to see him." But of course, COVID protocol, no visitors, no guests. You can't be in there until the patient is fully released into your care. And then we see Maggie and Winston talking on the phone once again, and he brings up, "Did I scare you earlier with the whole I love you thing?" And she's like, "No." And he's like, "Oh, well, I wasn't saying that to you. I was saying that to my colleague." Yeah, sure, okay. But this is good, playing with your character's vulnerabilities and emotional availability and everything like that. It makes for good writing because it forces them to extend themselves emotionally, and it also forces them to step out of their comfort zone. And then finally, the mother of the burn victim, Kaden Lee, is found in the hallway by Richard, and he's like, "Hey, what are you doing in here? You know there's no visitors allowed. You know protocol." And she's like, "Look, I need to see my son, Caden Lee. He just turned 18. He needs me. He needs to hear my voice. He needs to know that I love him and that everything is going to be okay." And here's the thing that I love the most about Richard's character. He is very compassionate. One thing he isn't is, cold and, cynical. He was never that way, even at his darkest moment. He's like, "Okay, fine, come with me." And the fact that he's taking a risk like that, knowing that Bailey will kill him, says a lot. And then we see Richard, Karina, who is DeLuca's sister, and Meredith and Miranda calling DeLuca in for an intervention. And Karina goes first. She says, "Andrea, the day you were born, when I found out I was having a baby brother, I was so happy. You will always be my baby brother, and I know you're hurting right now, but you don't have to be. All of us are here to help." And Richard steps up and he speaks too. He's like, "Look, DeLuca, even if you hadn't saved my life, I'd be here. I've seen class after class come through this program. I've done it enough to know when someone has something special. Don't throw it away." And Meredith says to him, "You know, what seems like a weakness is actually a strength if you get help. Because you care so deeply. You fight so hard for your patients, for the people you love. That's not illness, that's you." And Miranda speaks her piece. She's like, "You know, I live with OCD, but I take medication. I get therapy and I stay on top of it. And no, it is not always easy for me. But look, you're not alone. You have an illness. There's no shame in that." At that point, DeLuca goes off because think about it. Put yourself in DeLuca's shoes for just a second. You go into a room, and then there's a whole bunch of people in there, loved ones, people that you hold in high regard, telling you, "Let us help you. You need help," when he technically didn't ask for the help, but he does need it. The human response and reaction is going to be to fight it. And he says, "No shame. Huh, what a joke. My whole life I've had one goal, one thing that would mean I did okay. Don't end up like my dad. I wanted it more than being a surgeon. One thing, and I just failed. I don't care what you think. I don't care about Bailey's OCD. I don't care about saving Richard's life. I would give up every life I have ever saved if I could just not feel like this." He even looks at Meredith and he says, "I'd give up knowing you." And remember, they did have a romantic relationship, remember? And he breaks down and cries, and then he admits to them, "I know I'm not okay. I just don't know what to do." And that's a vulnerable moment right there. That's an emotional breakthrough. And Meredith says to him, "All we're asking you to do is fight as hard for yourself as you do for everybody else." And he finally agrees to get help. And then we see Meredith in the supply room. And she had to make yet another phone call that a loved one had died due to COVID. And she goes into a rage and makes a mess and throws things everywhere. And then DeLuca comes in. And I understand Meredith's anger because in this pandemic, even if you aren't a doctor, I think what a lot of people can relate to is the feeling of no control. It's like your hands are tied. People keep dying, and there's nothing you can do about it. Imagine being a doctor in this pandemic, having to give families bad news on top of bad news every single day. It takes a toll, mentally and emotionally. And then Meredith ends up berating DeLuca, like, "Hey, where were you? Why didn't you check in? We were worried about you." And DeLuca is like, who died? And Meredith is like, everyone. Marvin Lindstrom, Doris Sanchez, Tom Richardson, you treated him. And DeLuca's like, oh my God, yeah, the retired choir director. He loved fishing. I'm sorry I wasn't there. And Meredith is like, yeah, okay, you're okay. I'm glad you're okay. Just make sure people know where you are. And then the mother sees Caden. She's in shock. And also, what Richard is doing is against protocol, and Jackson calls him out, like, hey, you know that we can't have visitors up here. I know that's his mom, but are you kidding me? Bailey's gonna kill us. And Richard is like, look, if Bailey asks, tell her I didn't get to that part of the manual, okay? Give her a couple of minutes. And like I said before, it really shows Richard's compassion for people. And then finally, Richard finally stands up to Bailey, because all you diehard Grey's Anatomy people, you already know that Bailey trained under Richard. Richard is really the OG in this situation, not Miranda. Like, she's an OG now compared to Maggie and maybe Meredith and all them. But with Richard... oh no, Richard taught Miranda everything she knows. And he had no problem telling her that either. Richard says to her, you are not my mother and you are not my teacher. You are my colleague and friend. And of course, Bailey is like, and I am your boss and it is my job. And Richard's like, oh, don't tell me what your job is. I taught you my job and now suddenly you want to tell me what my job is? I brought you down here for some good news, but you're convinced that I'm incompetent and infirm and you won't even hear it. At that point, Miranda gets curious, like, good news? What good news? And he's like, okay, your staff is reusing PPE and cleaning them with bacterial wipes, which deteriorates the masks. And now they don't have to. It's revealed that he put all the masks in that room with that portable cleaning device that cleans them without a human having to do it. I don't know the proper name, you guys, all these medical terms, but, you know. Basically, in a nutshell, Richard made it a million times easier for Bailey. And Bailey's like, oh my God, you're a genius, but you were going to give me a second heart attack, you know that? And then we see Joe making amends with Jackson, and what happened earlier with that, she ended up coming to his house for, you know, friends with benefits, casual sex, whatever, and it ends up not happening because they both had two different ideas of how it would go. Like I said before, Jackson is more of a gentleman. He's more refined. He's romantic. He was at least like, okay, let me at least wine and dine her. Let me at least set it up like a date. And she was just like, oh no, this is just friends with benefits. I'm not even gonna put effort into my appearance. My hair is a mess. I'm wearing a ratty dress and some Ugg boots and a jacket. Two totally different ideas, right? And then Joe ends up crying and they end up not having sex because she's so distraught emotionally. And then after that, she just snubs him and gives him the cold shoulder. And Jackson is confused, like, okay, what did I do? What did I do here? And she finally tells him, no, you did nothing wrong. It's me. I'm mortified. I can't even, like, look at you because I'm so ashamed that I did that. I cried in your mouth. I literally snotted in your mouth. And I just can't face you. So it's easier to be mean. And then they end up making amends. They come to an understanding. And he's like, Joe, nobody expects you to be okay after what just happened to you. Baby steps, one day at a time. Your husband left you, high and dry, no warning. You didn't even see that coming. You didn't even know what was going to happen. So, of course you're hurting right now. Give yourself time, right? And then we see Miranda going to another parent and revealing that they are bringing his son back here to be treated. And then, of course, Caden's mother goes back to the tent where Caden's father and all the other people are waiting for their loved ones to be all right. And it's revealed that the two sets of parents blame one another for what happened to cause the car explosion in the first place. And Caden's dad is like, they shouldn't have even been out there to begin with, but they felt sorry for Frankie. And Frankie's dad is like, wait a minute, you think this was Frankie's fault? And Caden's like, yeah, posting all the time about how sad he is, he can't be with his friends. And Frankie's dad is like, okay, look, he missed a year of school when he was sick. Of course, he wanted to see his friends, and I don't need a lecture from Mr. Lakehouse here, okay? We all follow each other on Instagram. Did you really think we weren't going to see you grilling every night with half the neighborhood and no one in masks? You know, kids learn by example. Well, Caden's example is a selfish moron. Oh, why did he say that? Caden's dad throws the first punch, and before you know it, everyone is throwing things. Bailey tries to intervene. They knock her on the ground. She's calling for security. It's a whole mess, right? And then we see Meredith, and she's giving her final voiceover, or I should say, we hear Meredith. That's more accurate. And she says, disaster has a tendency to melt away everything else in life. So if you want to know who you'll be in a disaster, ask yourself, who am I now? End of episode. So this episode really gives an accurate depiction of what's really going on with this pandemic, what's going on worldwide with the medical industry, with the doctors. And the question is, what's going to happen when they eventually run out of ventilators? What's going to happen when they're filled to capacity? What's going to happen when even the doctors start getting sick? Because I don't care what anybody says, you can be the best doctor ever. You can be on Meredith Grey's level, but at the end of the day, you are still human, right? But anyway, you guys, thanks for tuning into the podcast. Much love. Be sure to click the link in my bio for script coverage evaluations and to get a copy of my free ebook, The Character Bio Playbook. And also be sure to tune in for my next podcast. Have a good one.